You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello, I'm Stuart Goldsmith and welcome back to the show. I'm sorry it's been such a long break. Haven't we all been busy? Let's get stuck in straight away. This is the first of the live Comedians Comedian recordings that I made in Edinburgh this year at the Gilded Balloon during the Edinburgh Fringe. Here is a wonderful comedian, Sarah Pascoe. Would you please welcome with a huge amount of love and enthusiasm and appreciation the wonderful Sarah Pascoe. Okay, I should probably stay standing until you get there. Take a seat, Sarah.
What a gentleman.
There we are. Lovely to have you here. Thanks for
this. Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
You'll need to forgive me for the slightly weird stagey capacity of it. I've been used to... I normally interview people in their places where they write. Oh. Where do you normally write? Do you have a particular place?
No. I don't have a particular place that I write. All different places. I write a lot around other people. I know some people need quiet. Okay. I can do editing and I can make myself sit at a computer and work on things, but essentially I like public transport or busy cafes, children's parks.
Creepy.
Oh, slide, eh? Very inspiring.
Okay, so you and... I never know quite where to start, because I don't want to start with something like, how did you start doing comedy? But okay, it's the first one. Let's do that.
Yes.
What's your origin story as a comedian?
Okay, so this is interesting, but it's going to make it sound like, if none of you have ever seen me do stand-up, I have been practicing and I am a writer now. But when you hear why I do it, you feel like, not really a reason to change career. Basically, I went out with a boy. He was a stand-up comedian. You won't have heard of him. And
you actually name him in your show, don't you?
Oh no, different boy.
Okay, sorry.
No, I name a boy in my show. Oh, it's so mysterious. 9:15. Assembly George Square. I went out with a boy who did stand up, and he was an open mic comic. I had never seen comedy. I was very snooty about comedy. I thought that stand up was improvised. I had seen three people on video: Eddie Izzard, Billy Connolly, and Harry Hill, and I thought they were improvising. And I thought that comedy in terms of like plays and stuff was really just frivolous and stupid when there were so many serious things going on in the world that we should all discuss and campaign about. And then I went out with this boy who did stand-up comedy, and I went to see open mic nights, and I found it very interesting because it was so bad and clearly written. And I was like, oh! And then this boy broke my heart. And I was in that stage where you have all of this energy all of the time. And so I did loads of things that scared me. Like, I had always had a fear of water on my head because of a bad school trip I went on. And, which is in my show as well.
I was going to say, see show for details.
And I did stand-up just as an experiment, and I got really drunk, and I'd written 5 minutes about how High School the Musical would make you really upset if you were a child and you thought other people were having that fun a time at school. And that it actually, hey, this has gone down a lot better than it did 5 years ago. And so I'd written about something that's happened on an inset day at school with between two pupils that I won't name. But basically, he fingered her behind the cricket pavilion. And they were caught by the teachers as they were showing people around. And so I wrote that up as if it was a musical, but not singing anything, but just saying, and then there'll be the... There was a great song in the drama club, which was about status and levels. Like, it was like that. And people smiled at me. And on the way home, I realised that everything in my life, without my knowledge, had been preparing me to do stand-up. Everything I'd ever done. I'm not a funny person in real life. I'm hilarious when people are looking at me. No, I'm not one of those people that's ever been told, oh yeah, you're a clown. I never used humour as a way of getting out of things. But I think everything I'd ever done in my life had prepared me to wanting to talk to people about things that I thought.
Yes. So you, something you refer to in the show, without wanting to give anything away, is you doing assemblies at school.
Yes.
And you were quite a serious, at school you were a campaigner, you wanted to transmit information to people.
Yeah, all the time. And I always thought that was acting I wanted to be. And I always thought that I had to be someone else to do those things. And then this discovery of stand-up. And also, I had been an actor since I was 18. And in acting, you have to work really, really hard to find your own work if you don't have an agent. And I didn't have an agent for 10 years until I did stand-up comedy. And I wrote letters...
Note to actors listening to this, that's not necessarily the way to do it. Stop it.
no. Oh, God. Yeah, the front page. Tomorrow, everyone has now become a comedian. That's all right. No, I forgot what I was saying. Oh, yeah. And then, but basically what I realised is that... So all of the energy that I used to put into writing emails and letters and begging people to see me or going to see other people's plays and waiting afterwards, I love your theatre company, I don't have an agent, how can I write to you, that kind of thing. Stand-up is so much easier because you ring a guy who's weird, his number is in Time Out, and you say, can I come and do 5 minutes? And he says yes to you and 20 other people. And then you go and do it. And like yes, all the time. Like rather than acting, which is like months and months and months, and people don't even reply to emails or letters, and that was really addictive because suddenly all the energy I was putting into something, and also you get better at stand-up the more you do it.
Yes, it's
actually,
very visible, isn't it? It's a very visible kind of curve.
Because you can do it all the time. So if you do 7 gigs a week, you get better quicker than people who do 1 gig every 2 weeks. And again, that's really addictive.
Yeah.
To actually feel something rewarding you for the energy you put into it. You're learning a craft. Which is another thing. The odd thing about stand-up is that you have to learn this craft in front of people. Like, it would be ideal if, I think for me, I think like 8 years, which is 3 years from now, and then I would like people to watch what I was doing. Because then I think I'd be more in control of it.
Yes, if you could somehow...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, you can only do stand-up, can't you, by doing it in front of an audience.
Whereas if I was going to...
Wouldn't it be good if you could then erase all of their memories after 8 years' worth and go, now I'll start.
Yeah, well, you can in a way, because then maybe if you do a really great show after 8 years, everyone's like, she was working towards that.
Yeah.
Now it all makes sense. Because if I was painting, I wouldn't... The first time I painted, I wouldn't come up here with my easel and say, hey, guys... Some blue, does that look like the sky?
I'm thinking I'm going to be pretty amazing at this, so everyone watch.
Yeah, and then every day, just okay, I'll have another go. Okay, does it look like a cow or a horse? Okay, it's still looking like a cow. Right, don't worry, next year, it's a bit horsier. It's a bit, you can see where I'm going with this. Which is what we have to do with stand-up. But then this is why I think people are fascinated in that process, about that process, they get to see it happen. Mm-hmm. And sometimes... There's nothing more exciting than watching a really new comedian. And you can see that they're new and that they're nervous and they've learned it and they're not quite at home or something happens and it distracts them. But they're doing stuff and you're thinking, oh, this is brilliant. Mm. I've never seen anyone do this. You're going to be brilliant. And that's really exciting.
Yeah. I'm very, very guilty of whenever I see that quality. And I was at Latitude Festival earlier this year and there was a person that I saw on stage doing like a sort of a new act. It wasn't quite a new act competition, it was like the chortle competition, I think. And I just can't help myself from running up to acts that I think are going to be exciting, going, just so you know, I've been doing this for about 7 years. You're going to be amazing. You're going to be so much better than me. Just don't ever take any advice from anyone and be brilliant and ignore everything. Oh, God, you're great. Like that. You really try not to do that. But at the same time, when you see it, you go, oh, wow.
But do you remember people doing that to you?
No one ever did. I do remember it.
You never forget it. And then because there are so many times where you don't do well at gigs, because you can't, doesn't matter how good you are, exciting, you go to gigs where the situation is wrong or you're in a bad way or there's no communication between you and the audience, it just doesn't work. And those things, like Richard Herring did a very similar thing to me very early on. You're like, is Richard Herring from Fist of Fun? Yeah. Like, he knows who I am and told me he thought I was good. And then that just overrides all of those things that can keep you going. So I think it's been really important to tell people.
Yeah, absolutely. Something you might have touched on there with the idea of not being able to practice, or you know, this idea of writing, like being like painting a picture, is something that I often struggle with, which is that stand-up comedy is so ethereal. You don't get a picture at the end of a day. You know, at the end of your gig, all you have as a memory of it is your memory and the people's memories who were there. And then the next morning you wake up and go, was it really that good? Or fortunately, sometimes you think, it can't have been that bad. You know, because it no longer exists. And I often feel quite jealous of people in other art forms, like painting or video making or filmmaking, whatever, sculpture, because they have a thing that they can prove and they go, see, that's my thing and it will always exist.
Yeah.
I made a bronze head and it'll outlive me.
My theory about this is that, so there's a personality type, obviously there's a spectrum of it, but there's a certain kind of person who chooses comedy rather than sculpture or a different form where you have something to show at the end of it, and that's because I don't think we'll ever be satisfied. Now, so I would say people I've met who do comedy are people who could pretty much do anything. Very, very bright people, very, very hardworking.
Yeah, not like these chums.
but there's a sense in them that they will never think they're good enough at anything, and they pick something you cannot win at. You do it forever. Okay. You can be Steve Martin, but you'll still sometimes have a bad gig. It's such a leveller. You can be the richest, most famous person, almost in a way, then you have to live up to that all the time.
Yes.
There's something really masochistic about, I will never be good enough at this.
Yes, and so you're suggesting...
And I'll never have anything to show for it, and it's like toilet paper, it's gone. People don't remember laughing. Say over a 20-minute set, so you go to a club, your first 5 minutes is amazing, and they are laughing, and you're like, I am owning this, and it's brilliant. And then for some reason it gets a bit quiet, so you go a bit in your head, start thinking, oh, what was it? Was it because I was talking about buses? Okay, I'm going to try something else. You do something else, and then they kind of sense you shift, and then suddenly the room is silent. And then you go, oh, crap. And then you carry on like you haven't noticed. And it's still going great, and I'm sure I can win you back. And then at the end, all of those people think you are shit and bad at your job. No one goes, well, we really laughed in the first 5 minutes. We were really laughing then. And actually, I think she did all of our laughs at the first 5 minutes. We just used it all up then. I read them out over 20 minutes. Yes. She was actually very good.
It's not, they don't even give you, the,
you
don't they don't even give you the grace of going, well, she was a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
Like you would with a band or with someone like a footballer whose career has kind of gradually gone down the toilet. You go, well, in the early days. You don't get that in that 20 minutes, don't you?
No.
But I think that's interesting that you'd look at it from that way round. Whereas to me, I've always thought, how unlucky is it that the job I've got is something that is ethereal and I can never pin down.
You chose it.
And actually you're suggesting, that's probably because I'm masochistic.
No one made
you. Chosen something
you
I
didn't
can never
go into
win
the
at.
Job centre after university and they went, okay, we've done your little test and you've got to be a comic, sorry.
Yeah. it would be sorry.
Sorry.
This is going to be difficult and expensive. And not only are you going to lose touch with all your friends, but your remaining friends will find you risible for the degree at which you talk about yourself. He said in a podcast of his own devising.
So here we are. This is an interview with Sarah, who is, I think, an absolutely fascinating comedian and a fascinating artist as well. She really has a sense of comedy as part of an artistic or a creative tradition that is really excitingly articulated. This is a chat about her life, and the second half in particular has got some really good in-depth explorations of her working processes and some of the principles to which she adheres. She's probably the person I've interviewed so far who has the most considered and articulate theories about her comedy. We're going to be talking about the sleep state when one is half awake and how that can be very fecund for creativity. We'll talk about the pursuit of happiness, something many of you know is dear to my heart. How do you be happy whilst being a stand-up comedian? She seems to have some... She's really got her head screwed on about this. We'll talk about the relationship between realism and truth, how male comics are often atrocious. We'll talk about what Sarah would do if there was an apocalypse and she had the resources of a primary school, which is a fascinating way of looking at things. I think it's very interesting. We can talk about improvisation and some really exciting, some really very interesting... I improvise myself on stage, but I'm not an improviser. I don't go and do impro, so to speak. From Sarah's description of it, she's really sort of piqued my curiosity there. And there's also some really good examples where we look at Sarah's notebook and we work alongside her on some ideas for some new things and where she might take them next. This is sort of nominally series two, which all that really means is there's been a break. I've decided I'm going to intersperse the live recordings that I took at Edinburgh with some pre-recorded ones, maybe alternately, maybe differently, with these kind of... The regular ones you'll listen to, you're used to, the more sort of knocked up in my shed kind of ones. The comedy community seems to be taking this podcast very much to heart, which is brilliant. So thank you, everybody. Lots of acts are approaching me about being on the show, which I'm very excited about. Often I'll be working with someone and they'll say they like the show, which is always very nice to hear. Here's a little fun thing, though. Just so I can separate acts who want to be on this podcast because they think it'd be good for their careers from acts who want to be on this podcast because they actually listen to the show, I've got a little plan. Now, I'm not making a value judgment there. I don't imagine it would be useful for anyone's career particularly to be on this podcast, but it's always an interesting chat and I'm very flattered that anyone wants to come on and do it with me. I'm not sort of judging people who don't listen to the show, but obviously you who do listen to the show are better. You're all super goldsmiths. So if you're... I'm beginning to regret ever mentioning that again. If you are an act and you want to be on this show, if you are, and I'm sort of talking to headliners here, I'm going to do this open spot special as and when I get round to it. I sort of didn't realise in advance how much more faff and organisation it would take to do an episode with lots of conversations. More fool me. But I'll be doing an open spot special before too long, a newer act special as well. But this is really to headliners if you're into the show, or anyone that's pro, basically, any level of pro. I know now there'll be open spots going, I once got paid £20, I'm in. I'll leave it to your conscience to decide. The point is, if you're an act and you want to be on this podcast, when you see me, and there's no need to email me, I'll get round to everyone in good time, and I'm already getting a lot of correspondence from open spots, but when you see me, just say at some point in our conversation, I'd be pleased for you to introduce me to your beautiful daughter. That's the key phrase, okay? Then I'll know that you're a listener and you get priority booking on the show, so to speak. So the phrase is, I'd be pleased for you to introduce me to your beautiful daughter. I just thought that'd be fun, really. Well, so I'll see. I'll get to see how many people actually listen to it and how many just want to go on it. But this is not all aimed at comics, this show. It's not all just aimed for comedians. I feel like I've got a bit of a foothold here. But I think this show should be interesting to other non-comedy doing people as well. So please, you the listener now, you, yes, you, please do me a favour, right? Bear in mind, this podcast doesn't earn me any money. In fact, it costs me money to produce and I don't charge you for listening to it. I don't even advertise. In fact, if you do know how to make money from a podcast, please get in touch. Someone did once, but they sent me, it was a very kind of, it was my first episode and they said, thanks for your many hours of podcasting. And I thought, you haven't even listened. But if anyone is interested or knows how to monetize podcasts, I'd be fascinated to see how I could turn this into cash. So anyway, sorry, I'm excited. I'll tell you why in a minute. So bear in mind that this podcast costs me money and I don't make anything. Until I work out how to make money from it, do me a favour. If you're a fan of the show, do this one thing for me, right? Think of a friend who would like the show, who you think would enjoy it. Not a comedian, a real human person, okay? Picture their face. Think of a person. Have you got it? Someone that you know is interested in comedy and would be interested in learning how it's created. Think of that person. And now choose your favourite episode of the ones so far and post a link to that episode on your friend's Facebook page and let's get some humans on board. All right? So I'd really appreciate it if you did that. I'm keen to spread this out to people who aren't already comedians, much as I love all of you comedy people who are currently listening. So here we go. Let's get back to Sarah Pascoe.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So you were talking about campaigning attitude. Oh, yeah. So yeah. You saw stand-up initially as less of a means of making people like you,
yes,
and more of a means of transmitting the message that you wanted.
Okay, I'll be honest with you. I want to be a politician when I'm older, and this is all an overarching plan to get better.
I can't tell
you people.
I'm not joking.
My plan is 30s novels. I'm in 31 now, so I'm about to get to novels. I'm going to write some novels. I'm going to live in France. And then at 40, I want to do another degree. I want to do PPE at LSE,
okay,
which is a lot of letters. And then I'm going to be a politician from my 40s onwards and stand up. So basically, my plan is to get really, really good at stand up, because the funnier you are, the longer someone will listen to you. If you can make people laugh, you can be incredibly earnest. People are doing incredible things where, whether you agree with them or not, you listen to their opinion on something. And like, there's this 16th century tract where universities were deciding whether they should admit humanities as subjects, because, and this guy called Philip Sidney wrote, it's called In Defense of Poesy, mm-hmm, and he said, if you make someone enjoy themselves, they learn so much more. And that's why stand-up is incredibly powerful. No one has to use it for power. We can all just do dick jokes if we want as well. I don't think everyone should do it, but for me, I felt, and I'm not there yet, and every year my show is getting a little bit more, I will allow myself to like mention that I'm vegetarian and do one joke. Whereas ideally, I would come out and do an hour of like, you bastards, how can you do this to me?
At the end of which you'd have been so charismatic and funny that people would walk away going, this really is going to change my life.
Next year,
because
my show,
you've been funny rather than because you've gone, you bastards.
My show next year, I want to do about eating meat, because it's so important that we eat meat as a species. It's why we have a conscious brain. We're only one of only three species that went from herbivore to carnivore, or vice versa. And giant pandas were carnivores, now they're herbivores, and they're dying out. Like, it's really fascinating. I don't think that we shouldn't eat meat, but farming's like really fucked up. Mm. I'm gonna find a really funny way of talking about it so that no one feels lectured, and that's my next chin show.
Sure, it's called You Be the Chicken.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. You Be the Chicken.
So there's a lot of autobiography in your work as well. As I really
it is
noticed,
now, but I never used to. I used to feel really like, why would anyone want to know anything? I've only stand up for 5 years. I've only started in the last 8 months saying anything true about myself.
Really? Yeah. Just in the last 8 months?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so this show is all true, but before that, I honestly thought, why would anyone care?
Okay.
Or be interested?
So just for a bit of context for people who haven't seen the show, the one or two people here who've not seen it. The show is called Sarah Pascoe the Musical, and it's your life story.
Yeah.
And it's not a musical, it contains musical elements, which I think are very deft and very, I love the way you do those, they're very exciting. I heartily recommend the show. But it's one long story about various things you got up to in your adolescence.
But actually what it is, although I don't say it because you should never be explicit, like if someone says to you, and that's why I'm a comedian.
Yeah,
we got that.
We got
that from all the reasons you're a comedian that you told us. So, but essentially, I was a liar at school. I got in a lot of problems because my first thought is to say the most interesting thing, like that part of my brain. And that's why I'm a comedian. It's that part. I never have writer's block. I can always make shit up. And I have to stop myself as an adult telling people stories that they have told me happened to them, as if they'd happened to me.
Yes.
When anything happens, like, and I still have this urge when someone goes, oh, I'll be in Tesco and something will happen, and then I'll go, oh, it would be much better if I'd said that. And when I tell the story, it's like, and then she said, and then I was like, and then the man fell off his stool, and then, but now that I say that on stage rather than to people.
Okay. So this is what I was going to ask. Given that it's a true story, how true is it? How much poetic license is there in the events? Have you taken certain true events and kind of tickled them up to increase the jeopardy or what?
The one thing I've done is change the end of, my first boyfriend kind of split up with me without telling me, and I didn't realise that could happen because I was a teenager, and I thought if someone loved you and they said that you were going to get married and you were 16, that was pretty much going to happen. And so it was this real surprise when he just started going out with someone else and didn't talk to me about it. And then I haven't seen him since I was a teenager.
Sure.
But then we did meet up again. But the actual real story that happened is really dull because we went to Brighton, he's married with three children, and then he started sending me sexual text messages, which were really inappropriate, and he's a vicar in a really weird church. And so eventually I sent him a text back. He sent me a sexual text message that he was in. I never ever replied to them. It was so inappropriate. And also I was like, fuck, 8 years too late. Like, 17-year-old me would have died for this. So he sent me a text message that he was in a hotel room masturbating, reading Ernest Hemingway, drinking red wine. He was an amazing guy. He could really multitask. And he said, I wish you were here. And I wrote back, don't worry, God is with you. And he wrote back, wow. And that's the last contact I've had. But he lives in New Zealand, which is why I'm thinking it's all right to do a show about him. I use his real name and everything. But anyway, that ending never really kind of... So I had to kind of just make the essence of how I was... we got back in contact. So I had to do something, but that story was too long. The more interesting thing is, all the stuff I really wanted to talk about, I've had to take out. How my parents met, I had to take out.
Okay.
Because people... were split. Half of them felt sorry for me, and half of them thought I was making it up.
Okay.
And no one was laughing.
Is that because it's a particularly outlandish?
My dad is a pop star in the 70s, and okay. My mum stalked him. When she was 40, and he wasn't like famous, but they were on Top of the Pops once, and he had a TV show with Pauline Quirk. And my mum decided she saw him on television, decided she was going to marry him. Right, and she did. She was 14, she slept outside his house in Dagenham with lots of other girls, but basically what she did is she wore him down, and when the band split up, and she waited until they were no longer famous, she was the last person turning up outside his mum's house, and eventually he relented, and then they got pregnant with me really early on. So my mum was 18, and my dad was 20,
okay.
And then they had me, and I kind of ruined their lives, and with hilarious consequences, like that. So it was all about kind of, I wonder why that didn't work out between those two, but in my show, it just made people just thought I was, and also the other story was because I ran away to meet Robbie Williams when I was 14, because I thought, this is how you got a boyfriend.
Well, to be fair, with a certain amount of previous, yeah.
Because you do, I still think I'm going to marry someone incredibly famous. Like, I just felt like it was my destiny. And so Robbie left Take That, and he presented The Big Breakfast for 5 days. And me and my sister ran away instead of going to school every morning. My mum was so angry with us, but we thought she'd been a hypocrite. So we stole money from her purse, and we went, we're like, what's dangerous about sleeping by the canal in Stratford? And we waited there every day with all of these other girls, just when he came out and he talked to us, and I made eye contact with him, and I was like, it's on. Like, I'm too young now, but there is a frizz on, he knows.
You just need to be the last woman waiting.
Yes. And
after
then,
he stops
when
being
I was fed. 19, I worked with his dad in a hotel as a backing singer, his dad Pete Conway, and then I was like, this is definitely on now. I'm friends with his dad, any minute now he'll be popping by in a helicopter. But I had to cut all of that stuff from my show because people were reacting like it was really dark, whereas I thought it was kind of, that's what teenagers do, they delude themselves.
Sure.
And people run away and people have unhappy relationships that result in children.
Just those stories feels like next year's show anyway. That's
do you
a
think?
Whole other, yeah, absolutely.
I
that's
think
a whole
you,
other...
you guys are much nicer than anyone I did a preview to.
That is very difficult, that thing of previewing a show and trying to guess. Trying to determine people's reactions. Let's talk about that for a bit. If you're, because the stuff you do, I mean, it's interesting hearing you say, my stuff is true, but you actually said you have to delete true things because they sound outlandish or they sound too much. Whereas I sort of always imagine, or maybe you're the same, is that you'd sort of think, a boring true thing happened and I had to add stuff to it for the sake of personalising.
Yeah.
I mean, do you
ever do that?
But
you know what? This is the thing, it's not about boring, it's about honesty. Because actually, if anyone tells you exactly what is going on in their actual brain, their inner monologue, it's fascinating. Everyone's psyche is fascinating. The comics who I find really dull is because they're not actually being very emotionally honest. There's nothing more intoxicating than someone kind of opening a vein and going, and this is actually how it felt.
Yeah.
and it was this, and I didn't have so what you're doing with the writing is finding a way to communicate as close to the truth as you can how something felt, and that's connecting with other human beings. And then that's really fascinating. You can tell me the most boring story,
sure,
but if I'm getting inside your head while you're there, it's really amazing.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just think it's that. So there's two ways of doing it. You can make big external exciting stuff happen, or you can make internal things happen. Because that's the thing. The story could be, I spilt some milk. But your emotional reaction to that, and everything that spreads out of it, it's like Proust. Yeah? Yeah, guys? How long is she going to until she brings up Proust? Proust wrote an entire book about a bit of cake in some lime blossom tea given to him when he was ill in bed as a child by an aunt. And the taste of it made him realise he wasn't the only person in the world. And it, the book kind of splits out like that from this bed that he's in. And then it's like the house and his family, and he kind of understands his parents. And then it's the rest of the town and all of these characters and the architecture. And that's a book from a taste sensation.
Sure. So is there obviously what you're saying completely makes sense from the point of view of revealing the inner life.
Yeah.
Translating that into stand-up comedy, translating that into something that's funny, I think maybe that's where a lot of people, I'm certainly guilty of this myself, you end up, I mean, you don't want to ever generalise, but at the same time, you're trying to strike a chord with people that's not simply striking a chord and having people go, oh, I understand that, or oh, I felt that myself, but it has to be satisfying and surprising.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. How is that translated?
There's two
into
ways
the
of doing that, because people do the thing of like, you know when you're on a bus, right? And yes, we know when you're on a bus, so we're all there. Or they do the emotional thing, which is happy, sad, lost, confused, didn't think I was clever enough.
Yeah.
I was the best. Maybe that's me. That's sometimes where I lose people. So we're not as good as you, Sarah. We don't know what you're talking about. that's the two ways. But laughter is an interesting thing. So have you read any books about why we laugh as a species?
Yes, like Desmond Morris.
Yes, so it's really fascinating because we laugh to reassure each other that everything's fine. It's why we laugh a lot with groups and very rarely on our own. Because there's no point. We laugh to say to people around us, everything's fine. And we do it for different reasons. We do it for wordplay when our brain corrects what was wrong. And that's why there's always a gap. With a great comic, there's a gap between them finishing, our brains working it out, and the laugh. And apparently the longer that gap is, the bigger the laugh, because we're more satisfied that we've done all that clever brain work and put it all back together, and now the world is fine again. Mm. It's why we laugh when someone falls over and is fine. But we never laugh if someone falls over and the old person, they've hurt themselves. Mm. It's exactly the same thing, but that's not fine, it's not funny. We laugh to go, fell over, oh, ha, 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 you're fine. And it's why people laugh, and audiences, sometimes you don't know you're doing crap because you laugh to reassure someone. So if you're doing new stuff, sometimes you'll go, oh, that didn't work. And everyone goes, ha, 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 ha. And you think, great, I'm storming this. That's a big laugh. Or actually everyone's going, it's fine, we still like you, carry on, keep trying. And then you have this laugh of recognition when someone is describing something and the laughter like, yes, kettles do take ages to boil water.
Yeah.
Why do we just walk around doing our lives without talking about this? Literally no one ever talks to me about how long my kettle takes to boil water. And that's the other part. It's really lovely when you suddenly go, yeah, I understand that. So we are all the same human beings.
That's a great conclusion just at that point, isn't it? So what's the journey then of finding, you know, of describing an experience where you spilled some milk and trying to make that funny? To try and go, okay, this is a thing. I've got to be honest about the things I feel about this
situation.
Well, that's
one way, because the other way is because people are, this is abstract is what we should talk about as well. Because it's the same as painting. Something doesn't have to be realism to be about truth. So there are abstract comics who do this amazingly, where they tell you a story where they spilled some milk, and then the goat started talking to them, and then they went through the mirror, and then the landlady was really angry, and they do that, but the essences, the emotions of that story are all about truth.
Okay.
And that's why it's still funny. And,
sure.
And when people do that really badly, which is what I did when I very first started, like I said, it was all lies. I was that guy, that was my material I was doing there. I wrote that. I didn't. You're not sure. So abstract. So how do you do the journey? I guess, surprise is one thing that you said earlier. And
Because it has to be surprising, it has to be satisfying, doesn't it? Yeah. I think to get a laugh, it's got to be something surprises you, but in a satisfying way.
Yeah, and that's why, if you can guess the punchline, because I think if you're in an audience, and I do think this is everyone, you do think you know where people are going. You can't help it. And it's why some of my favourite jokes is when you think you've done the punchline, and they know that you think you know the punchline. And so it's such a nice surprise. When anyone mentions Marmite, you go, love it or hate it. That's the first thing you think, as you're expecting that is the punchline. Marmite is like carpets. Oh, that's not a good example. Flying with Ryanair is like Marmite. Very cheap. Because all of us, when I said that, are going to go, you love it or you hate it, and then I'm going to explain how Ryanair divides people. And so, I didn't. Sure. It was a lovely surprise.
Sure, so you pull the rug.
Yeah, of course. Because that's the thing, really good writers, whether it's instinctual or conscious, they know what people's brains are doing because they know how their brain works. So you can manipulate that.
Just to change the subject, something we were talking about when we were at Mac Festival and we had an excited, drunk conversation about comedy. I made a couple of notes about it afterwards that I wanted to talk to you about. One was the thing you were talking about, Tim Key and the 50% rule.
Oh, yeah.
Which we'll talk about in a moment. Yeah. But the other thing that I sort of underlined was we were talking about fear and about how fear can be the enemy of good work on stage. Do you, as someone who is primarily concerned, like I worry that when I'm doing stand-up comedy, I'm too concerned with being loved. Mm. I'm basically transmitting, love me, like me, like me. And you know, maybe if I say clever enough, funny enough stuff, then all these strangers will approve of me. Seeing as you seem to come from it from a very different angle of saying I want these people to understand the thing, do you think that gives you a different type of fear on stage?
Yes, I think. But what's interesting is I think the comedians end up with the audiences they deserve and that want to do the thing they need them to do. So you need to be
loved. A lot of these people got in free.
But you need to be liked on stage and you will end up touring to lots of people who really are invested in you and want to like you and want to please you by liking you. Does that make sense?
Sure, unless I manage to break out of this thing, which I have at least spotted and want to not
but
do.
But there's no reason you have to. I feel like you can't fake who you are. Stand-up should end up being you at your purest because you are working on you all of the time. If you try and be a different you, everyone knows you're phony. Mm-hmm. And not just you, everyone. Like, we sniff it. We read people's body language. We know when someone's lying to us. And if someone's trying to fake that they're like, hey, I'm really up and jolly, and it's really great to be here, guys, you're like, fuck off. Like, you're dead inside.
Here's a little thing. Over the rest of the festival, silently, without shouting it out, every time you see any more stand-up, see if you can work out how honest it is. That's quite an interesting game to play,
Who's them on stage, and who is it? Yeah. And I'll tell you why my fear... I don't know... But I tell you why how I deal with my fear. I am content with mediocrity. I do not need to be the best. Okay. I don't need to be the best at a gig. I don't need to be the best in my life. I am just a human being who is trying to get better at a thing.
Yes.
So I am, and I'm not perfectionist in any way, shape, or form. I think perfectionism is crippling. I'm 31. I've not done anything in my life that I could show you and go, I'm really proud of that thing I wrote or that thing I did. But I think life is about hope. I want to be like 65 or 70 and be in a play at the Royal Court and be like, that I was good in that.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I want to live my life. I would never want to peak now. And the content with mediocrity thing, when I have a bad gig, it's like, what do you expect? You're learning. Or, you made a mistake there, which you will now try to learn from.
Do you mean mediocrity? Do you mean average? Because that resonates with me for a thing from cognitive behavioural therapy, which is to dare to be average, which is a means of trying to undermine your own perfectionism. Mm. If you really can't be happy unless you've made it. I mean, I saw a very famous comedian before they were famous come off stage and they just smashed the gig to bits and they came off and they were kicking the wall going, oh, for God's sake.
There's a lot of those guys.
There's an awful lot of that, and that's very seductive.
Wearing. And they are children, and no one tells them. You end up with the audience you deserve. They end up with these entourages of yes people. And if you ever dare to say something like that, I think you're being very rude.
Yeah.
They will never talk to you again.
Yeah.
Like, and they'll be like, I can't believe that person did that.
Yeah.
And it's really disgusting. And also, no one ever tells pretty people off. You're pretty. Do you get told off?
Not often.
No. Okay. No one tells the pretty boys off. They get away. They treat women.
You're pretty as well.
Appallingly. Okay. The pretty boys. I am a very good human being. I don't go around sleeping with lots of boys that I meet at gigs.
No one tells the pretty boys off for sleeping with lots of girls.
They are atrocious. I have had friends who have gone out of a male comic and found out he was going out with someone else, like in the toilets when they've gone to watch his gig, and another girl has invited them both to his gig.
Wow.
Is talking in the toilets about her boyfriend who's just been on stage. Like, they're honestly really, really messed up human beings.
I feel like it's an unspoken question as to whether or not I've done that. I haven't. I'm not that pretty.
Wouldn't it be great if that was both of our story, we're both pretending, so it was me who came off stage and snatched stuff up. I was like, oh really, you're telling that anecdote? Well, I'm going to tell them one about the girls in the toilets.
So you were saying, so no one tells them off. Pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So yeah,
if you hate them privately, everyone goes, oh yeah, he's such a dick.
Yeah.
But no one ever goes, oh, I think you're behaving really badly to people. They just let them get away with it. And it's like, I guess with music as well, you think, oh, someone's creative, if they're like an artist, then you can be an asshole, or it must be such a difficult process. Of course you don't just like be polite to people.
Mm.
Like, no, that's completely
unfair. There's a street performer friend of mine called Dirty Fred, who's very wonderful. You should try and check him out. He's from America. I don't know if he'll be here this year. But he apparently said, I've heard this secondhand, but performers are very fond of the fact that I forget people's names. Oh, it's because I meet a lot of people. Oh, I'm so sorry, I've forgotten your name for the nth time. I'm sorry, I meet a lot of people. Dirty Fred is keen to point out, everybody meets a lot of people. It's just performers are dicks. That's effectively it. So but the reason I mentioned that kind of never happy, that perfectionist attitude, is in cognitive behavioural therapy, there's this thing called Dare to be Average, or it's a chapter of a book. Dare to be Average, because you will end up making better work when you're happy and relaxed, because your goal is no longer to be the best thing. Yeah. Is that the sort of thing you mean? Because mediocrity seems like quite a mean way of describing
it. But I think that's something I'm happy with.
Okay.
Like, because if I'm... Just now, like, that's the thing. If you're focused on this end goal, as in, like, I want to be brilliant at stand-up, I want to be Stuart Lee in 20 years.
Yeah.
Okay? What you don't see is the whole process that it takes to become Stuart Lee. You just go, oh, I'm so focused on that, and I'm so bad in comparison.
But
that doesn't make you want to write anything.
Sure.
And so instead you just take that away and go, I'm never going to be Stuart Lee, but I am going to be slightly better in 20 years than I am now.
Yeah.
And if that's never that good, that's still fine, because I enjoy this and that makes me happy.
Yeah.
And that's what I think we forget as well. People, I mean, not just comedians. But being happy is the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you think, no, it's because I'll get that job and then I'll have that money. Or,
yeah, why do you want the job or the money or the fame if not to make you happy?
Yeah, because actually you might be happier if you went swimming more and bought a bike. But actually your life might be nicer.
And that's
a solvable thing. Or if you just ate better. People might be happier, drank less, slept more, got into, German cinema. Like, it might actually enrich your life more than that job would or that money would.
Yeah.
But we never go, okay, what is it that actually would make me happy? Getting a pet, guys. Do you hear me?
So we've been lessons in life here.
What I'm going to be like when I'm Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Okay, NHS is closed, but there's pet bursaries.
let's talk about this thing you said about that Tim Key told you about audiences.
Yes.
I think that's absolutely fascinating from how a festival experience works.
Yes, right. The thing is, comics are really supportive of each other, don't you find? Like,
definitely. So far more so than you'd expect.
Yeah.
You would think it would be sort of bitchy and backbitey.
Yeah.
And
it's an amazing support network, because everyone knows how difficult our job is and that it goes badly sometimes. And I find it so wonderful, and the fact that everyone, we're all trying to work out what the hell we're doing and how to do it better. And so Tim Key said to me last year, and he's obviously so successful now, and I think it's his 7th or 8th Edinburgh.
I think so, yeah.
And he said to me that you don't really get good until over 50% of your audience... Or do you think you're good? Because once over... So basically, if no one in the room knows who you are, you're very new, you have some convincing to do, and sometimes that won't work. And if 30% of the people already like you, there's still more people in the room who are kind of cross-armed, thinking, okay, you could still be shit, or could decide you are shit when you start. If over 50% of them have seen you before, or come because they've heard you're famous, or a TV programme, or seen you something else, then actually... it's much more likely that the people who don't know who you are going to be convinced that way than the other way around. And then you can just do the work that you want to do, like it's in a vacuum. Like, I always think, I always test myself, like, if there was an apocalypse and it was just me and the resources of a primary school, what would I make if there was an absence of audience? And that should be what you make anyway.
Okay.
And I think that's what happens. If over 50% of, because you then don't have to compromise as much. You can go, right, I think this is brilliant and I want to talk to you about it for an hour. And if 50%, if over 50, half of those people agree that you are brilliant, they'll go, this is really weird, but I trust you are better than me.
Yeah.
And so you know what you're doing.
Sure. That's, I mean, the reason why that came up in conversation, I think, was because we were talking about sometimes it can feel grinding, the process of coming up here and performing a new hour every year. You spend all year writing that hour. You worry that your normal bread and butter gigs at commercial comedy clubs at the weekends, you're not doing your best stuff at those gigs because you're always running in new stuff to fill this hour-long void that reappears every September. And for a lot of people, it's phenomenally expensive to come up here as well, and it sort of keeps you in relative poverty given how much work you're doing. So I think it was really interesting looking at that from the point of view of, I mean, I remember being told, okay, like when I came up with a sketch show, we did 2 years worth, and we kind of went, well, no one's really noticed this. No, nothing's really happened as a result. And I think you've got to come, someone told me you've got to come up for 3 years to prove that you're serious.
Yeah.
And then you've got to be good, you're being good every single time. And then your fourth year, you've got to be really, really good. So they go, oh, right, oh, they really mean it. And then in your fifth year, things can happen. And that, you know, looking at that financially, you might go, oh, well, that's going to cost me 60 grand over the next 5 years. That's my plans at that deficit.
I say two things. Number one, there is no science to Edinburgh. And every year we get another thing like, okay, it's all about year four. And actually, there is no science. Some people are just really brilliant at it straight away and it works and there's an audience for them. And other people come for much longer than 4 years and are consistently good. And I had my hair cut and she was like, who do you recommend? Scottish. And then I was recommending, I could see her just going glazed over as in she doesn't want to see any of those people that she hasn't heard of.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say, how many of my friends have second jobs, as in they work 9 to 5, they get up at 8 or 7, they go do a job, they then drive to Somerset, do a gig, come home, have 2 hours sleep to pay for Edinburgh. And there's a thing, I think sometimes the things that we do that are bad in our shows or where people really suffer is they do pay a fortune for it. You pay before you come and then you pay for it afterwards. That is why some of them are like, so it's so hard.
Yeah.
Because I think audiences, why would you not? Like, you see this huge poster of someone that someone's made and all this money put into it. Of course you assume everyone's professional.
Let's talk about jokes, about making material.
Oh, yeah.
I've asked you to bring a notebook with you, which we'll have a look at.
Yeah. I brought two, because this is my next year's show.
Okay. Oh, so you've got next year's show with you in a book.
I've got some notes. Yes.
Okay. And it says, I am the notebook of truth.
Yeah, because my show next year is called Sarah Pascoe versus the Truth.
Okay, so you've got your title already at this
stage. Yes,
so
I was going to do it this year. It's the vegetarian show, but I couldn't make it funny enough. And I don't think I'm good enough yet to actually talk about it, but I think I definitely will be in 12 months. That's all it will take.
So you are you're a writing things down person.
Yes.
Lots of people.
I always have
been.
This thing. No, I said that thing about everything I've done in my life has prepared me to be do stand up. I have diarised my entire life.
You have.
I can write, and I keep more than one diary. I keep an emotional diary for big events. I had an acting diary for every drama lesson, every play I was in, every assembly, which I analysed to make myself better. And then I had my day to day logistics, like where was I, how did I feel, why did he say that. So that's three diaries minimum. And then when I started acting, I wrote up every audition. Had to be A4. I was really strict on myself. You have to write A4. And then I would click the audition thing to it, and then I have a huge folder of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that's happened, I've always written every day about myself.
Okay.
And then I was like, there's a job.
Yes, there's a job where all of this makes sense.
So I got up, and why did you say that? And I just completely prepared for it. So that's the thing is, again, when people talk about finding writing difficult, I don't have that.
Yes, okay. So something a lot of comics that I talk to say is that they're either a writer first and a performer second, or the other way around.
Yeah.
You're obviously a writer first. So when you have ideas, do they always, how does the idea crystallise? Let's try and plot that journey. So you see a thing, or you remember a thing, or you
think of it, yeah.
Okay.
I think it's much more, just it kind of occurs to me. I think it's to do with sleep state, I would say quite a lot.
Okay.
The bit just before you fall asleep, or the bit when you wake up and you're worried, that's when I think I get ideas. And I think quite often something's bubbling there, you're not even conscious of, you never actually look at it directly, and it's kind of half written itself. Do you have that? Does
yes,
that make sense?
Yes, yeah. I do, yeah.
And Samuel Beckett said that the only time you could be truly creative, you were actually paralysed. Do you have this? I think everyone has this. It's a human being thing, but there's this moment, it's almost like a microsecond, and it's almost like you're not thinking.
Okay.
Like, there's just this kind of blank state happens, and he tried for his entire life to move in that moment, because he thought that was the only time he could actually write the truth.
Okay.
But conversely, it was the only time you were actually in tune with the universe and understood everything. It was just that kind of... And then
it's like a brief moment of nirvana, just a flash of sort of stasis.
And he wanted to learn, and he thought he could be able to extend it through meditation stuff. But
So how much time do you spend ruminating on an idea, or do you have the idea and immediately get it down on paper and start writing?
I wouldn't write it up, I would write down the notes. So I have long lists of... And it will say, like, they have little stars where it say, idea, femme fresh.
Okay.
And I know what that means. I saw a Femfresh advert and I thought, it was disgusting. So I thought, that's the thing, that's the kind of thing I would write a thing about.
Okay.
Because it's about, oh my God, vaginas are disgusting, buy expensive stuff so that no one can smell we've got one. That's the kind of thing I would talk about on stage. Because the advert, have you seen it? It says, woohoo for your frou-frou.
Yeah, it's this intensely patronising...
Yeah, it's really... But it's also frou-frou. Like, they just say, for your genitals. Like, we're adults. I just think it's such a weird thing. Anyway, so obviously that's not written, but it's the kind of thing I will talk about in a really funny way.
Okay, so... Yeah. So
I've just written that down.
So you've written Femfresh, and then do you write around that subject? Do you expand that subject? Do you improvise on stage around that subject? What's the...
All of those things. Okay. So if I'm having a gig that's going really well... which is most of them, I will go off on a stream of consciousness, and then I love it, because I think you can trust that if you talk for long enough, you will be funny at the end of it.
Okay.
I trust that in myself.
Okay.
That's a very... I'm embarrassed I've said that, because that wasn't even joking arrogance. That was I'm very good at this.
That's
joke.
Okay. This is no...
I'm not scared of the little bit where you're talking about the Femfresh advert, because I know at the end I'll find some way of making that funny.
Okay. And that's born of experience as a stand-up comic life experience?
I'm an improviser.
In a theatrical improvising
yes,
kind of
way. I'm in an improv group and I studied improv and I read improv books. And improv is the most amazing thing for creativity, because it's all about throwing things away and not stopping yourself and never thinking. And it's always about making someone else look good, which is actually a wonderful thing to be as a human being. You've always got everyone's back. You will never watch anyone flounder. You never enjoy someone else doing badly. If you don't want to enter a scene, that means you have to.
Okay.
Because if you're going, fuck, this is... Like, the minute you have that thing of this is going badly, which means they need me to come and help them.
Okay.
It's all so positive. And it also just has a thing where you go, the human brain is amazing. It finds patterns. Just because I don't know where this is going at the beginning, I will by the end of it. And also, improvising is just talking. And children are amazing at it, because we unlearn how to play and tell stories to each other through... out our adolescence, and then as adults we can't do it, or we have to learn to do it again.
Yeah.
Children are amazing improvisers.
It's the most awful thing sometimes I find.
And comedians, they're amazing comedians.
When I'm playing with my godson, I've got a very strong relationship with my little 7-year-old godson, and we play this zombie game in the park where with him and whoever mates around the swings, and I start pretending to be quite a realistic zombie. And chasing after them, they all run away scared, they've all got a certain number of lives, the game has kind of adapted and moved on. But I keep finding myself blocked in a way that I wouldn't have been when I was a kid, because I'm busy playing the game, kind of showing off to other adults, and you know, but kind of look how well I'm getting on with the kids, they love me, approve of me, and but I find I'm doing that, but as I'm doing it, I'm also blocked in the game by kind of going, I'm old now and I can't be bothered to climb up that thing, which by these rules, but you have to climb it now, you know what I mean? You have to kind of get back to that childlike
thing. They do a thing in Bikram yoga where it's like, it's the exercise, it's the postures you least enjoy that you need the most.
Yes.
Because actually if it's difficult for your body, it means because that's because you're tense there and you need to, and the only way to get out of that is to do that posture.
Yeah, okay.
And to tell yourself, I really need this.
Yes.
Oh God, it's this one.
That's a really good rule in comedy, isn't it? Because going towards the awkwardness and going towards the silence and the risk of disapproval and all of those things.
And also,
that's
what
I mean.
Also, again, things about calling things. I think we shouldn't be scared of people. If you talk about something and you kind of feel like you've lost people's attention, I think you then say, I feel like I've lost your attention because you're not interested in this thing. And again, it's the honesty thing. I think then you get people back because you're talking to them.
Yes.
Again, about something they are interested in, which is them. all of a sudden. Okay. Like, why Stuart Lee is so brilliant is because he does amazing comedy while also analysing his comedy and letting you into it.
Yes.
And dissecting you as an audience and how you're responding to it.
Absolutely. So it's always engaging, whether you're engaging with that on that level or that level, or what about you?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll maybe have a bit of time for questions at the end, but let's just keep going into the notebook for for what you would do. Do you have a thing? Could we, in fact, I'll tell you what, in the last 10 minutes or so, could we look at something you've got as an idea that isn't a joke yet?
Okay,
and
well,
we'll follow what you're going to do with it next to turn it into a joke.
Okay, right. I wrote some down because I put some on my iPhone. Predictive text. I had this idea that predictive text, predicts the future. So you write in, sorry, Laura, I'm running 20 minutes late. And then it comes up, the Mughals will attack from the east. That's an idea I could write about. It has to be better stuff, and it has to be like much clearer about kind of dates. But I think there's a lot there.
Okay.
Maybe, unless someone's done it.
Yeah, I didn't understand the Mughals will attack from
the east. I didn't understand it.
Okay, fine.
I mean, this is what I mean.
But you could shrink it and go, Laura, I'm going to be late, so and it auto-corrects it to, sorry, I was late.
No.
No.
No. Nostradamus said that the end of the world would be when the Mughals... I don't think Mughals is the right word.
Okay.
But basically, people who lived near China in the mountains, they would attack the West.
Mongols?
Maybe that's
As
it.
As in Mongolia?
Yes,
that's
what it is. And I think my brain went, you can't say Mongols on stage. Say Mughals? That sounds more businessy.
So
what
fine,
I mean is, predictive text. You say, sorry, Laura, I'm running late. And it says, you'll die when you're 72. That. See?
Yeah.
So it's predicting the future.
Okay.
So that's how good iPhones get.
Sure.
Or like, okay, I'll warn him. Like that.
Okay.
I think you could predict lots of futuristic things, and then you do callbacks to it later on when those things happen.
Yes.
Or, I'm not going to get a mortgage. Why would I? I'm dying in 2 years. So I think that's the thing. Doppelganger. Someone told me on the internet they'd seen me in an advert. I don't do adverts. I'm going to be a politician, and I'm really strict about it, and I don't do voiceovers or anything. I even hate doing gigs that have branding from alcohol. Someone told me they saw me in an advert. I was like, they're so desperate to have me selling products. They have got lookalikes. And I watched the advert, and she's just a blonde girl. People have blonde blindness. There are loads of comedians who are ladies who have blonde hair, and we all get congratulated for each other's gigs. I get Roisin Conaty, me, Casey Wilkins, Pippa Evans does it in an American accent, and Rachel Paris, who plays the piano, and we get tweets for each other, and Tiffany Stevenson.
Okay.
And we just all get it. Like, my sister the other day, she saw Roisin Conaty on Russell Howard's Good News, and I went to her house, she just had a baby, and she went, oh, Sarah, I'm really sorry. There's this girl, and she's so like you, but better. And the thing is, I think actually she's talking about things that people actually understand.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen. Because she literally meant, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but your career's been taken. There's no room for you. There's a blonde girl. For the doppelganger thing, I had this idea that if I had someone who looked exactly like me, so I play this for real, so not like, what if, like, there's a girl who looks exactly like me, how can I be sure my boyfriend won't sleep with her? Because, and is that cheating? Because he thought it was me, but it wasn't. So he has cheated on me, but I'm not allowed to be angry, which makes me furious. And when I'm out of the house, so I'll be at a gig, I'll be out of the house, worrying about what he's doing. Like, because what if she says she's me? That is the kind of thing I would say. And so that's an idea.
What's the next step? Let's follow that idea.
Okay,
so what do you
idea.
Do next? Do you improvise it on stage?
Yes. So the fact that I've just said that out loud now makes me go, that's not that funny. Right, so that's honestly what's happened. I would do that, a new material thing, and go, I don't think that's that funny an idea. But what I might do and try and do is set it up better, set it up quicker.
Okay.
And go, I don't do adverts, need to joke about adverts, but that's easy. It'll just be like, femme fresh, woo. And then, and then I'll say, but they've got someone who looks exactly like me to start doing adverts. I've got a doppelganger. If my boyfriend sees, so I'll get there much quicker.
Yes,
so the beginning
okay.
bit. And then I brainstorm like a thing.
But you'd work on, with the doppelganger thing, you'd improvise that once as you have done the essay. Not that this is a comedy club audience necessarily. But would you then would you ever improvise it again without doing any extra work on it? Or would you just think, oh, maybe that wasn't
well,
right?
I think your brain does extra work, even if you're not. So I wouldn't have a pen in my hand. But the fact that these things have even like occurred to me as ideas, I feel like my brain's working on all the time.
Sure, okay.
So I wouldn't necessarily write it down, but I could improvise it again and it would be better.
Okay.
Because I think your brain is just doing maths all the time, going, that is the bit they laughed at, that's the only joke in that.
Mm-hmm.
Not then, but like in the scenario that we're talking about, you'd go, that's the only funny bit at that moment. So number one, end with that, because mm-hmm. at least they laughed then. And I think your brain does that already subconsciously.
Gotcha,
And yes, and then I would write it out on a pad, and so I overwrite it. Obviously, you have big chunks that you end up taking out, and you could brainstorm something like in a spider diagram, and where does that go, or what does that link to? And always, if you have a sentence, it should have at least some joke in it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, you know, I need all this it needs to explain, I don't do efforts, but you have to have a joke there.
Okay.
You see?
Yes. And then
I do a lot of typing up on computer. Some people don't use computers, but
I use a computer and I find it quite difficult because I can end up spending a working hour really cutting and pasting and reshuffling rather than creating any new stuff. I find that could be a bit of a trap.
But also the problem is then suddenly when you're on stage, when you've really, really worked on exactly the wording, I suddenly feel like I'm saying a script.
Yes.
And so the first two or three times I say, I know it's better, but I feel very much in my head remembering the exact wording which makes it a better joke.
Yes. Gotcha.
It's much better if it sculpts itself from, you say it 50 times, and after 50 times it's perfect, and then you remember it word for word like that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just thinking consciously of time. Are there any questions from the audience? I've got another, little, we can follow this for another minute or two, and I've got a sort of a final question. There's a question over there. Thank you, sir.
Well, we've been trouble.
Have
you lost the book?
What's that? Oh, if I lost my book, would I be in trouble?
That does happen to people, doesn't it? People, Ignacio Lopez had his stolen recently.
Well, there is a lot of it I wouldn't remember, and I like collecting things. Like I say, I've always written diaries. I still have them all, and so my most satisfying things. I always use these moleskin-sized pads. Is like finishing one and putting it on the shelf next to the others and going, my biographer is going to have such a nice time.
So would you,
I've written about everything that's happened.
But you don't have any backups of them, though, do you? If your house burned down, God forbid, what state would that put you in? Would you think, God, I've lost everything? Or would you think, I will simply create more?
Again, it's just about an attitude. So that's the thing. When you lose stuff that's expensive or you lose stuff that feels personal to you, I just think you have to go, and now it's gone and there's nothing I can do. And rather than having this frustration, I can't change the things that have happened, I think I would be like, well, yes, you've lost your pad, Sarah, but you're going to write better jokes. And probably the world thought that those jokes weren't good enough. And also, maybe someone will find it and say your jokes, and they will still reach humanity. that would be my inner monologue.
Excellent. Time for one more question, probably, if there is one there. If not, thank you for yours. The last thing I was going to ask, because we really must wrap up, what will I ask you? Are you like the sort of comedian you thought you would be like when you started doing comedy?
Comedy has changed my life and made me a better person and made me happy.
Okay.
So I had no idea. I didn't think I was going to be a comedian. Like, I'm an actor. That's my actual job. And I have become one. And it so far exceeds my expectations, as in I have the life of a 9-year-old. I have a bicycle. I swim every day. And then I go out and laugh at people I think are really funny, and who are also my friends, like people I think are amazing, I'm friends with, like, and who know who I am. So incredible. And then I don't eat sweets, but I do drink a lot, which is like growing up sweeties. And so does that make sense? The two are so intertwined for me.
Sure, the lifestyle and
yes, that every single day of my life. And that's the thing, like, I always, if I ever stopped enjoying going to gigs, I would stop doing it. I don't have to do this.
Sure.
So I would stop doing it. But at the moment, I'm still in the honeymoon period. I don't understand how anyone doesn't like it. And I think, why are you doing it then?
Yeah. That's a lovely sentiment on which to finish. I should just let you plug your show briefly. It's called Sarah Pascoe, the Musical.
I know most of you have already seen it, but come again. Yeah, so it's at 9:15 in the evening times at George Square.
If you go down past where the Spiegel tent is, down the left there and then down some stairs. It's very well worth seeing. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in thanking Sarah Pascoe?
So that's that until next time. I thought that was fascinating. That was the first live one I'd done with an audience bigger than about four. And I was confident it would work, but also nervous. And I think actually we got a really, really good conversation out of it. And I had a really good time in Edinburgh. I've got some really fascinating other shows to share with you, with Josh Widdicombe, Hannibal Buress, Eddie Pepitone, not to mention Rod Gilbert. Terry Alderton's show was fabulous. Alan Davies, very interesting. So, and Pappy's, oh my God. I always get stuck in this. I have to name out all of them now in case they're listening and they think I don't care about them as much. They were all great. But I will be releasing them every so often. Do keep bullying me on Twitter about when new episodes are coming out. I quite like that, and it keeps me motivated. Send in your requests and your recommendations for guests, anyone you'd like to have on the show. It's info@comedianscomedian.com. Join the Facebook group if you like. You can find that easily if you're on Facebook, Comedians Comedian. And please imagine that one person who you think will like the show and share it to them. Just put it on their Facebook page, or email them, or send them a Facebook message with it on. And let's try and sort of spread this out. That would be really awesome. And that's not giving me money. You're not selling anything. That's the thing about marketing. You just need to give people a thing they'll like. So let's just give some stuff away. I am off now. I mentioned I was excited earlier on. I'm going to go and warm up the Big Fat Quiz of the 90s, which from the point of view of a warm-up is either going to be a really awesome fun or a really long, painful five-hour record. So nonetheless, that's where I'm off to. I hope you enjoy the show. I'll speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.